Welcome to Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz, the only program willing to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. Your host and guide to victory over communism is one of the nation's most experienced national security journalists, Bill Gertz, who uses unique facts, pinpoint analysis, and exclusive interviews to identify and counter today's destructive communist ideologies. Now, Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.
Welcome to the podcast. The VOC podcast is focused on ideology, not people. Each episode addresses either Chinese communist ideology or American Marxist ideology. The purpose of the program is education, to help people understand that these destructive ideologies have caused massive harm to humanity. Yet their proponents persist in seeking power over the United States or from within it. This episode is about Chinese communism and will examine and critique the Chinese Communist Party Constitution. I've mentioned before that I did a debate hosted by the group Intelligence Squared in New York City back in 2007. The Oxford-style debate addressed the question, "Beware the dragon, a booming China spells trouble for America." You can still listen to the debate and the arguments of myself, Michael Pillsbury, and John Mearsheimer, who explained why China poses a major threat. Against that, we were facing off against pro-China talking points proposed by James McGregor, former chief executive of Dow Jones in China, Daniel H. Rosen, a former White House official who helped facilitate China's entry into the World Trade Organization, and J. Stapleton Roy, a former U.S. ambassador to China and former managing director of Kissinger & Associates. Kissinger & Associates has done tremendous damage to American security through its work with the Chinese Communist Party. Henry Kissinger, now 100, was recently feted in Beijing as the guest of Chinese Supreme Leader Xi Jinping, who has called him an old friend. The debate proved to be a win for the pro-China advocates, with 41% of the predominantly liberal New York City audience supporting the motion and 37% opposing it prior to the debate. Yet after the debate and we made our points, supporters declined to 35% approving, with nearly 60% voting against it. During a conversation afterwards, I spoke with debater James McGregor, who worked as a key advisor to both the U.S. and Chinese governments. McGregor, a Mandarin speaker who worked as the Wall Street Journal's chief China bureau chief after the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre, went on to be chief executive of Dow Jones China business operations. Later, he was a venture capital investor in China. He told me that in 20 years in China, he never met a communist, something I dismissed as extremely unlikely, as the Chinese Communist Party rules China with an iron fist, and no leader of any stature for any organization in China has to be a party official or under control of a party official who makes sure that nothing can be done that is out of line from the CCP. This is clearly spelled out in the Chinese Constitution, the CCP Constitution. All party members, as a condition of their membership, must dedicate their lives to advancing the communist cause. I urge McGregor the next time he is in Beijing to visit the People's Revolutionary Military Museum, something I was able to go to during one of my reporting trips in China in the early 2000s. The museum is run by the People's Liberation Army, and prominently displayed inside the museum were 20-foot-tall bronze statues of communist founders. They included Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Vladimir Lenin, and Joseph Stalin, and of course Mao Zedong, the founder of communist China, who has been credited with the deaths of at least 60 million Chinese who died under communism through extermination campaigns, party-produced famines, and forced prison labor. The military museum, not surprisingly today, has no exhibit on the People's Liberation Army forces that were ordered to attack tens of thousands of unarmed pro-democracy protesters who had been camped out in Beijing's Tiananmen Square until they were massacred by the PLA forces in June 1989. To this day, the Communist Party of China has never been held accountable for this crime that set off the latest communist ideological campaign now being promoted by Xi Jinping against democracy and freedom as lived in the West. So, let's take a look at what the Chinese CCP Constitution says about communism and its role in China under the CCP. For this analysis, I'm using the English translation of the version revised at the 19th Party Congress in October 2017. This is the most recent version available. The opening paragraph states explicitly that the party's highest ideal and ultimate goal is the realization of communism. Further, the CCP is regarded as the vanguard of the Chinese working class, the Chinese people, and the Chinese nation. It poses itself as the leadership core for the cause of socialism with Chinese characteristics and represents the developmental demands of China's advanced productive forces, the orientation for China's advanced culture, and the fundamental interests of the greatest possible majority of the Chinese people. That's according to the Constitution. Next, the Constitution states that the Chinese Communist Party uses Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong thought, Deng Xiaoping theory, the theory of the three represents, the scientific outlook on development, and Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era as guides to action. It's important to understand this statement in the context of communist ideology. Unlike political philosophies of the past, communist ideology is both a political theory combined with plans for action. The variants mentioned in the Chinese Constitution make clear that whatever differences each Chinese leader may have had since Mao first took power in 1949, every one of China's communist ruler was committed to the anti-capitalist agenda of communism, and all regarded the United States as the leader of world capitalism to be vanquished in creating the utopian ideal workers' paradise. A vision that drives communists but will never be achieved because this tenet of Marxism-Leninism is based on false economic and political concepts and destructive anti-human and anti-God tenets that will never produce the promised ideal. The CCP Constitution states further that Marxism-Leninism reveals the laws governing the development of history of human society. The Constitution even seeks to recognize past failures of communism by stating that, it, quote, its basic tenets are correct and have tremendous vitality. The highest ideal of communism pursued by the Chinese communists can be realized only when socialist society is fully developed and highly advanced. The development and improvement of the socialist system is a long historical process. By upholding the basic tenets of Marxism-Leninism and following the path suited to China's specific conditions, as chosen by the Chinese people, China's socialist cause will ultimately be victorious, the Constitution says. This section explains the basic myth of Chinese communism, that is, the false notion that the CCP is one with China's 1.4 billion people. Yet according to the latest figures, Beijing's figures, the CCP now includes 94 million members. The Constitution also presents another falsehood, that the Chinese communist system is actually democratic. This falsehood is the basis for the current propaganda campaign led by Xi Jinping to oppose the true democratic systems of the United States and the West, and as well as in Asia. The CCP refers to this as People's Democratic Dictatorship, which means the party dictatorship is all-powerful, and what it says, not laws, is policy. It was Mao, according to the Constitution, who combined Marxism-Leninism with what are termed actual practice, the actual practice of the Chinese Revolution. This early iteration of communism in China was used to target what the Constitution called a long revolutionary struggle against imperialism, feudalism, and bureaucratic capitalism that brought about the falsely described New Democratic Revolution in China. The CCP then began the socialist transformation that has produced a socialist system and socialist economy, politics, and culture. Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, then applied their ideological variants to Chinese communism. Until, that is, 2012, when Xi Jinping came to power and imposed his brand. This new communist ideology is called Xi Jinping Thought on Socialism with Chinese Characteristics for a New Era. And it's described as a continuation of the earlier variants, but importantly, it's described as the most modern adaptation of Marxism. The 2017 Constitution was written prior to the unceremonious removal of former leader Hu Jintao, who during the 20th Party Congress meeting was escorted out of a major session while confidential papers were taken from him. The removal was ostensibly as a result of ill health, but the facts show his removal is just the latest political purge by Xi. Expect Hu's ideology, which is called Scientific Outlook on Development, to be removed from a future iteration of the Constitution. The major shift in emphasis under Xi's ideology is almost a North Koreanization of Chinese communism that praises the supreme leader for great wisdom and the promulgation of the so-called China Dream, which really means world domination under Chinese communism. In reality, Chinese communism under Xi today is destroying the earlier, less ideological pathways that began in the 80s as a reaction to the excesses and radical communist policies of Mao. Under Xi, the party has been tasked with another revolutionary task called reunification or the unfinished civil war against the Chinese nationalists who fled the mainland and took up residence on what is now a free and prosperous Taiwan. It states in the Constitution that all party members must hold high the great banner of socialism with Chinese characteristics, have firm confidence in its path, theory, system, and culture, implement the party's basic theory, basic line, and basic policy, and strive to fulfill the three historic tasks of advancing modernization, achieving China's reunification, and safeguarding world peace and promoting common development. Achieve the two centenary goals and realize the Chinese dream of national rejuvenation. The Constitution also includes another great fallacy of communist regimes everywhere, that the road to communism, while historically predetermined, will take time. China is currently in the primary stage of socialism and will remain so for a long time, the Constitution says, adding that socialist progress and modernization will take over a century. The reason for this section is that the principles and ideals of Marxism-Leninism are based on Marx's false dialectical materialism and historical materialism, ideas that will never produce the promised ideal workers' paradise. Thus, the CCP must remain in power forever until the alleged inevitable arrival of communism, an arrival that will never happen. These concepts are based on false and outdated Marxist ideas that have shown that I have shown will never produce progress or modernization or an end to the world's problems. The reason for this is that the problems Chinese communism seeks solutions for are not rooted in capitalism or any other economic system. Yet the communist anti-capitalist ideology is driven by a lust for power in pursuit of that utopian ideal. And once power is achieved, the communists follow Lenin's methods of using any means, including terror, to hold on to power through a system marked by anti-human controls and institutions. Here, I want to note that Marxism is quite frequently mentioned in Chinese propaganda outlets, but Leninism, the ruthless seizing of power by a small band of revolutionaries who, once in power, can commit any atrocity in pursuit of communist goals and objectives, almost never is mentioned by the Chinese propaganda outlets. The CCP Constitution sets out what it calls the four cardinal principles of the party. They are to pursue the path of socialism to communism, to uphold the people's democratic dictatorship, i.e. unchecked rule by the CCP, to maintain the dictatorial leadership of the Communist Party of China at all costs and by all means, and to uphold Marxism-Leninism and Mao Zedong thought as the foundation for building the country. The CCP Constitution is an important document that helps to clearly understand that in communist China today, we're not dealing with a normal nation driven by traditional geopolitical goals and interests. The true nature of Chinese communist ideology is revealed in the document, along with the false concept of democracy that it espouses. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File, that's gertzfile.com, or at the book site called deceivingthesky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to GoFundMe.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to GoFundMe.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. This is the counterproposal section of the podcast, or as I call it, the spiritual section. Counterproposal is based on the spiritual teachings of the late Reverend Sun Myung-moon, who devoted his life to bringing about a true understanding of the nature of humankind, the universe, and God. In this episode, I'm going to talk about Western naivete and the expansion of communism. History shows that populations have been fooled by false ideologies in the past. In Germany after World War I, Germans turned to Hitler and Nazism as a way to bring about better conditions in Weimar Germany. It was a disaster for the world that would be embroiled in World War II, killing millions and producing the Holocaust that killed 6 million Jews. Then, during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, there came to be a persistent naivete in the West toward Marxist-Leninist ideology that closely resembled the blindness shown toward Nazism by the United States some 40 years before that. It wasn't until President Ronald Reagan began exposing and denouncing Soviet communism in the 1980s that support for the Soviet Union among liberals eventually evaporated. Then, under reform communist Mikhail Gorbachev, a failed program was launched to try and change the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. That ultimately led to its and the entire Soviet Union's collapse. What occurred in the case of the Soviet Union is being repeated today regarding Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics. Many today among the elites and the intellectuals still regard anti-communism as something actually worse than communism itself. Decades of false indoctrination about communism and socialism in schools and universities and now other sectors of society have created a grievance and resentment culture that is being exploited by Marxists and communists to attack the free market system, which no doubt has its shortcomings, but which has produced unparalleled prosperity. Today, many people have come to sympathize with Marxists because they feel that their criticism of the social system and government will lead to a better system. What people fail to understand is the disaster that would be produced if there were a Marxist-Leninist takeover of leading democratic countries in the world. Today, like the Cold War and during the rise of Nazism in Germany, we live in the midst of a new ideological deception. Like Nazism and Soviet communism, Chinese communism promises justice and a better way of life, but this is a deception. In reality, the advocates of Chinese communism and their sympathizers are working to destroy the system of freedom and democracy that has produced the greatest advancement of the human condition in world history. Our lives today are enriched beyond the wildest dreams of our forebears. Yet these free and open systems are facing extinction and destruction in the face of a potentially existential battle and ideological competition that is all but unrecognized by most political and other leaders. Like Lenin in pursuit of power in Russia, Chinese communists today are working to weaken and ultimately destroy Western systems by denouncing corruption within the West as failing to meet the needs of all people. Lenin, in the run-up to his successful 1917 revolution, promised peace to the soldiers, land to the peasants, and self-determination to the non-Russian minorities. Although he temporarily fulfilled the promise of land that was later rescinded by Stalin, Lenin did not bring peace, but a destructive civil war. He did not free Russian minorities, but created a new Russian empire. His reign brought terror by decree. He replaced the Tsar's 15,000 secret policemen with a secret police force of 250,000. While he was in power, Lenin was responsible for the deaths of millions of people. In China, when Mao Zedong occupied Tibet, his forces tortured Tibetan monks to death by pounding nails into their eyes. Mao's close associate Lin Biao admitted that 18% of the political prisoners in China had been executed. In total, the Chinese communists murdered at least 67 million people. The murderous regimes in North Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, Cuba, and elsewhere also produced similar mass death and privation. In the West, during the Cold War, despite the mass deaths being carried out by the communists, there was adulation of communist leaders in the Soviet Union. Even as he initiated the Soviet terror, Lenin was proclaimed as a hero in the West. Stalin, his successor, received similar treatment. In the December 24, 1930 issue of the New York Times, journalist Walter Duranty wrote of Stalin, "It is easy to speak admiringly of men who have proved their greatness by success, but Stalin has been tried in the fires of prison, exile, and disaster, of civil war, when at times his cause seemed desperate, of leadership challenged by men of greater mental agility, of terrific material obstacles to his policy, and he has come out stronger from each test of his strength. He is veritably like steel, not rigid like iron, but resilient and able to bend, as his modification of the agrarian policy last March made clear." The agrarian reform, which Duranty commented on, eventually cost the lives of 7 million Ukrainians. Similar failures to understand the deadly nature of communist systems were witnessed by Western liberals toward Cuba, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Nicaragua. Today, led by the Chinese Communist Party, the West is being infiltrated and subverted by the concepts of social justice that falsely portray the United States as a source of all the world's evils. This is not an exaggeration. America is being subverted by lies and deception. Other supporters of communist China assert that just as the Soviet Union did not impose real communism, Xi Jinping's China today also is not real communism. The arguments of the Chinese communists echoed in other Marxist movements is this: here in our country, communism is different, or will be different, when we take power. We will build true Marxism, not the bastardized version seen in Moscow's system. The new communists insist they will have what has not existed anywhere. They promise to build a just Marxist society. Yet every Marxist takeover has resulted in the same barbarism and economic failure. Even today, China's command economy is beginning to falter as Xi seeks to follow hardline Marxist principles while moving away from the quasi-free market system that brought prosperity earlier. In understanding communism, it is urgent that we learn the lessons of the Holocaust. Hitler's intentions were clearly expressed in his book Mein Kampf. But people either failed to read Hitler's works or they didn't take them seriously. What happened in Nazi Germany was an application of Hitler's worldview. What is happening in China is the result of the application of Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics, just as it is described in works such as Marx's Communist Manifesto, Lenin's What is to be Done, and the CCP Constitution. So what are the ideological and moral parameters of Marxism-Leninism? It would be naive to think that they are the same as our own. Foreign policy expert Charles Burton Marshall once observed that in the language of game theory, communists and non-communists are like opponents playing different games by different rules on the same board. The United States, the free nations of Asia and Western Europe, and many other countries are involved in a game which looks towards a resolution of conflict by the partial accommodation of interests of all parties. The achievement of a stable equilibrium, called peace, is its goal. This game conceives the opponent as fundamentally reasonable, with limited objectives, oriented to compromise, ready to discuss issues on their merits, to play by rules, and obey the referee. Communist leaders, on the other hand, play a game that looks towards a resolution of conflict by the defeat and absorption of the enemy. This game conceives of the opponent as a mortal enemy, bent on annihilation, eternally aggressive, and treacherous. The only rule of this game is the rule of the jungle, survival and victory by all means. There is no referee. The world is the board. The communists do not act from a Judeo-Christian perspective. Their moral system is different. Vladimir Lenin contended that the communists should be ready to resort to any trick, ruse, or illegal method in order to advance revolutionary objectives. Commonly used expressions or terms with vague meaning for the West have clear and surprising definitions for communists. For example, according to Leninist thinking, peaceful coexistence is a revolutionary line. A revolutionary strategy. The purpose of the strategy of peaceful coexistence is to assure the conditions favorable to the victory of world socialism. CCP leaders in Beijing often speak of peace, win-win cooperation, and the rule of law. But what is peace? What kind of peace is being addressed? Like Lenin, Xi Jinping believes that the policy of the People's Republic of China is a policy of peace and peaceful coexistence. But the reality is that the CCP policy is what Lenin called merely another form under the present condition to fight against capitalism and significantly against the world leader of capitalism, the United States. For the Chinese communists, real peace will only be achieved when the world is communized under China's brand of Marxism-Leninism. China also plays on its alleged century of humiliation, a period between 1839 and 1949 when China's government lost control over large portions of territory at the hands of foreigners. This is a key element driving the Chinese communists today in seeking global supremacy. As China expert Alison Kaufman put it, although the PRC government maintains that the century of humiliation ended when the CCP won the Chinese Civil War in 1949 and established itself as the ruling regime, there remain several vestiges of that period that in the minds of many Chinese must be rectified before China's recovery will be considered complete. The most important of these, perhaps the only one that is non-negotiable, is the return of Taiwan to the mainland. This is what currently is driving China toward a new world war. China's communist system is also engaging in strategic deception about its drive to dominate the world. What is being described by U.S. military commanders as the largest military buildup by any nation since World War II is a clear sign that China is no longer limiting its strategy simply to modernizing China. The CCP goal is nothing short of taking over the entire world in pursuit of the false promise of a communist workers' paradise that rather than that ideal assuredly will result instead of a hell on earth featuring 21st century communist death and abuses on a massive scale. In many ways, Chinese communist ideology may appear from the outside as absurd intellectually, yet its quasi-religious nature provide communists with unusual power, a consistent view of history for those who adhere to it, and providing citizens at every level a feeling as though life has meaning, thus fulfilling, albeit falsely, a basic spiritual need. It is, in fact, our repeated failure to recognize the role and importance of communist ideology that is the reason communist China is now poised to spread its influence over ever larger areas of the developed and underdeveloped world. In an era without faith, communism has emerged as a powerful anti-faith, which renders irrelevant our accustomed frame of reference. It cannot be defeated militarily, and its adherents cannot be bribed into giving it up. The solution to defeating communist ideology must be done by first educating people to the facts of the ideology and then providing better ideas to replace those of Marxism-Leninism. Marxism based on materialism is completely out of date due to the development and implications of scientific advances by Einstein in his view of matter and energy, as well as new developments in physics that ultimately will be used to understand the nature of God and the universe. In the current century, science is no longer a friend of Marxism. It is a friend of the believers in God. The 21st century is a time to launch an ideological offensive against Marxism. Likewise, we must reflect on and reevaluate the status of the free world. What do we stand for? What do we want to accomplish? The implications of the Judeo-Christian worldview are great. The ideal and the hopes that stem from that worldview are compelling. Through an ideological offensive, the VOC worldview will help us to see ultimately the decline and fall of Chinese communism, similar to the fall of Soviet communism. Once that takes place, I'm confident there will be a reawakening of Western ideals and values that can address the problems that communism has falsely claimed to solve. The communist world continues to succeed in propagandizing about the injustices of the West. Foolishly, the Western media often serve as a tool in denouncing these injustices without pointing out that communism has no solution to these problems. It seems as though the liberal political outlook is such that there can be no criticism of communism because its roots are on the left wing of the political spectrum. This naive policy has succeeded in turning the general population against many governments and has left them with a blind spot as to what will follow should communism ever come to power. The media is aggressively promoting Marxist narratives of social injustice, racism, and climate alarmism as a means of promoting communism in the West. But little of the mainstream reporting is focused on similar impactful journalism on such issues as China's genocide in Xinjiang, repression in Tibet, the elimination of democracy and the CCP takeover of Hong Kong, and growing threats of war against Taiwan and Japan. The VOC worldview has two aims. First, we must recognize that Chinese communism is an ideological cousin to both Soviet communism and Nazism, and that all are barbaric in form. Secondly, we need to develop and adopt a worldview that can truly respond to the human condition. Nearly 80 years ago, the West learned its lesson when it tried to appease Hitler. Similarly, many elites during the Cold War adopted that approach toward the Soviet communism. The way to stop an aggressive force is through preparedness, not appeasement. The VOC worldview recognizes the need for a strong military posture, a better ideology, and a moral commitment to solving social problems. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters.
Welcome back. For part three of the program, the news portion, I'm going to discuss an important topic I've recently covered in the Washington Times in my reporting. It's China's development of brain warfare weapons. What is it? Well, the Chinese military is developing advanced technology weaponry designed to disrupt brain functions of leaders and populations using directed energy. According to a report I obtained produced by three open-source intelligence experts, the Chinese People's Liberation Army, as the Chinese military is called, is leading the world in the development of what are being called neurostrike weapons. The weapons can be handheld arms or larger systems that can directly attack or affect people's brains using microwave and other directed energy streams, such as electromagnetic beams. Quote, unknown to many, the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army have established themselves as world leaders in the development of neurostrike weapons, according to the 12-page report titled Enumerating, Targeting, and Collapsing the Chinese Communist Party's Neurostrike Program. Many think this may be what is behind the so-called Havana Syndrome incidents. That's brain damage experienced by American diplomats and intelligence personnel that was first discovered among those working at the American Embassy in Havana. The intelligence community, however, so far has dismissed these incidents as unrelated to any foreign power, but investigation and the incidents are both continuing. The new danger of China's brain warfare weapons prior to or during a conflict is not theoretical. The U.S. Commerce Department in December 2021 imposed sanctions on China's Academy of Military Medical Sciences and 11 related institutions. According to the department, these agencies are using biotechnology processes to support Chinese military end users to include purported brain control weaponry. The experts' report is one of the few public studies regarding this new advanced military capability. Neurostrike is a military term coined by former Special Operations Officer Bob McCrate. It is defined as the engineered targeting of the brains of military personnel or civilians using non-kinetic technology. The goal is to impair thinking, reduce situational awareness, inflict long-term neurological damage, and cloud normal cognitive functions. The three analysts who wrote the study are Ryan Clark, a senior fellow at the East Asian Institute of the National University of Singapore, Xiaoxu Sean Lin, a former U.S. Army microbiologist, and L.J. Eads, a former Air Force intelligence officer and current specialist in artificial intelligence for the U.S. intelligence community. The three experts say China's leadership views neurostrike and psychological warfare as a core component of its asymmetric warfare strategy against the United States and its allies in the Indo-Pacific. According to the report, neurostrike capabilities are part of its standard military capabilities and are not viewed as unconventional weapons limited to use in extreme circumstances. Likely areas of use for the weapons include Taiwan, the South China Sea, East China Sea, and the disputed Sino-Indian border. The threat, again, is not limited to the use of microwave weapons. China's new landscape of neurostrike development includes using massively distributed human-computer interfaces to control entire populations, as well as a range of weapons designed to cause cognitive damage, the report said. The research is focused on using brain warfare weapons in the near term, and possibly during a Chinese military assault on Taiwan, a target for future Chinese military operations that U.S. military leaders have said could be carried out in the next 4 years. Any breakthrough in this research would provide an unprecedented tools for the CCP to forcibly establish a new world order, which has been Chinese President Xi Jinping's lifelong goal. The Chinese Communist Party also could use these weapons against anyone they regard as opposed to its communist ideology or opposing Beijing's efforts to establish China as the sole global superpower. Additionally, these unique brain weapons could be combined with advanced population control technology China has developed that I call high-tech totalitarianism. The techniques include massive video surveillance of the Chinese population combined with big data analytics and powered by artificial intelligence. Militarily, brain warfare can be used in what the Pentagon has called China's anti-access area denial military strategy for the Indo-Pacific. Imagine at least partially immunized PLA troops being inserted into a geography where a specific weaponized bacterial strain has been released prior to their entry to prepare the ground and eliminate points of resistance, the report said. Any remaining sources of resistance on the ground are then dealt with through Chinese neurostrike weaponry that instills intense fear and or other forms of cognitive incoherence, resulting in inaction. That scenario would allow the PLA to establish absolute control over a nation like Taiwan, while at the same time blunting any American strategic options to intervene and send troops in support of Taiwan. The PLA could thus negate U.S. conventional military superiority with few near-term remedies for the United States. This scenario is based on known existing CCP research programs and what the clear strategic aims of those programs are, according to the report. Last month, senior commerce official Thea Rosman Kendler testified to Congress that her department is focused on denying China access to advanced technology that can be used by the PLA. The Assistant Commerce Secretary for Export Administration said that in addition to curbing exports of advanced U.S. microchips to China, the department is working to deny China access to the technology used in brain warfare and toxin weapons. Rosman Kendler said the department imposed sanctions based on U.S. intelligence indicating the Chinese military is working on, quote, novel biological weapons that evade detection, attribution, and treatment. The sanctions also target military development of artificial intelligence, surveillance, biotechnology, microelectronics, quantum computing, she said. For example, in December 21, we added the PRC Academy of Military Medical Sciences and its 11 research institutes under the PLA's Academy of Military Sciences to the entity list for using biotechnology processes to support PRC military end uses, including purported brain control weaponry, she said. The report by the three experts said placing China's Academy of Military Medical Science on the Commerce blacklist, barred from access to U.S. good, will result in the Academy's leading was the result of the Academy's leading role in developing brain warfare capabilities. A special branch of the Chinese military, known as the Strategic Support Force, is likely the main unit charged by the military with carrying out brain warfare. This Strategic Support Force is the leader in what the PLA calls the three warfare strategy of using non-kinetic weapons in war. The three warfares were disclosed in 2014 by China's National Defense University. They call for employing psychological warfare, media warfare, and legal warfare. Little is known about the Strategic Support Force, but available information indicates the force would be used to shape information environments on the ground and provide the PLA with better battlefield information than its adversaries. With additional neurostrike capabilities that can either damage, disorient, or even control perceived adversary cognition at the population level, the PLA Strategic Support Force would represent an exponential escalation of China's aggression in the Indo-Pacific, the report warned. Three warfare's operations already are underway against Taiwan, Hong Kong, the South China Sea, and along the Indian-Chinese borders. And the authors warn that the risk of a new brain warfare capabilities being used is increasing. The Strategic Support Force now operates a type of superstructure on top of a growing and increasingly active platform of Chinese military assets, which include weapons of land, sea, air, cyber, and space, across multiple theaters in the Pacific, while simultaneously serving as the primary deployment platform for the new neurostrike weaponry. To counter brain warfare capabilities, the report urges the U.S. military first to expose the threat of these weapons and then call for international talks and policy remedies, such as ethics reviews for neuroscience and cognitive science studies. Proactively, the United States also needs to engage in sabotage of critical supply chains of specific institutions or companies engaged in Chinese brain warfare research. Cyber attacks also could be carried out to disrupt Chinese neurostrike programs. Sanctions against all civilian and military programs linked to the brain warfare program also need to be strengthened. The objective of all counter-brain warfare efforts should be to dissuade China's leadership from deploying the new arms. Like the CCP's asymmetric warfare programs, Neurostrike depends entirely on presenting a massively decentralized and fragmented network structure. This renders it nearly impossible to map using traditional investigative or intelligence approaches. In other words, it's very difficult to find out what's going on in these programs. China currently lacks the defense industrial base needed to produce the technologies for an effective neurostrike program that can match its military ambitions. This presents a window of opportunity for the U.S. and its allies in countering this threat. This fundamental gap presents a massive vulnerability for decapitating strikes against the neurostrike program, provided that these gaps can be surfaced and precisionally targeted. U.S. and allied nations must locate key weaknesses in the networks involved in the brain warfare program. covert military action can make involvement in this weapons program a high-risk venture where technical failure and negative international attention are the most likely outcomes. The development of these brain control and damaging weapons is a clear example of the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party and its military forces that are taking action based on communist ideology that seeks global domination and the elimination of what it regards as the capitalist ideological threat led by the United States. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
I spoke to you earlier about my book, Deceiving the Sky. I also wanted to urge you to take a look at another book that I wrote called iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. We live in an information age, and yet we're getting bombarded with enemy propaganda coming at us from all different directions. iWar really helps expose what we need to do and how we need to counter it. I urge you to get a copy. The book can be found at iwarbook.com or at my website, gertzfile.com.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. I'm joined now for the interview portion of the podcast with John Lenchowski, who worked in the White House National Security Council for President Reagan and played an important role in one of the Reagan administration's crowning achievements, the stunning defeat of Soviet communism. John is a friend and also founder, president emeritus, and chancellor of the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C., and he's an expert on communism. John, welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Bill. This is great what you're doing.
Earlier in the podcast, I spoke in detail about Western naivete about communism, both its Soviet variant and now its Chinese iteration. People seem to lack an understanding of the role of ideology. It took Ronald Reagan to declare the Soviet Union an evil empire destined for the ash heap of history. Tell us a little bit about your background. You had a front row seat in the battle against Soviet communism. What was it back then that ended, you know, decades of unclear understanding of Soviet communism that eventually led to the collapse? Tell us a little bit about the history of defeating Soviet communism.
I believe, Bill, what was decisive was the fact that Ronald Reagan had conducted a lifetime of study of communism. He was not an amiable dunce, as he was once characterized. He was actually a brilliant man who had not only studied communism, but as a union leader, had fought the communists in their attempts to influence and take over decisive positions in Hollywood. And he was part of the larger U.S. labor movement, which had to fight communism within its ranks. After all, the CIO part of the AFL-CIO had been totally controlled by communists. Mm-hmm. And people like George Meany and Lane Kirkland and others had learned how the communists operate and had become the most significant, well-organized anti-communist group in the United States. And so Ronald Reagan's knowledge of all of this was absolutely decisive. And then the fact that he picked a number of people, including myself, who had studied communism and who understood its role in the Soviet system and did not suffer from the many intellectual and moral impediments to seeing communism accurately. And it was that very small collection of people that had a major role in formulating those policies that helped put pressure on the Soviet Union to collapse.
Yeah. Today we're faced with a new communist ideological challenge, and it describes itself as Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics. It's on the march globally and seeking to replace the U.S.-led democratic system with a communist one led by China. You spoke earlier this year on a Cold War strategy against China, and the remarks were an excellent litany of the nefarious actions taken by the CCP. What is the role of what Beijing calls Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics in these actions? Do you see Xi Jinping doing a revival of Marxism-Leninism now?
Yes. Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics, which is something which varies according to the exigencies of the party. What the party needs, they will, according to what the party needs, the ideology may be modified here or there. But the ideology plays a decisive role and has always played a decisive role since the Communist Party took power. There has been, as in China, as there was in the Soviet Union, a pattern and the pattern of governance, which fluctuates between periods of freeze, which means enforced ideological conformity, and thaw, which means loosening up a little bit on that conformity in the interest of greater productivity, particularly in the economy. And particularly in the Soviet Union, it was the military economy that counted. But Deng Xiaoping and others in China recognized that creating wealth, even in the civilian economy, was something that augured to the benefit of their military power and their internal security. But there are limits as to how far that thaw can take place. And I think that Xi Jinping and his confederates came to the recognition that there were too many problems with the thaw. And what happens when there is a thaw, a reduction in the use of ideology as a vehicle to enforce party discipline, mass mobilization, and mass conformity? Both, and this means thought control, speech control, ultimately to achieve behavior control. That when there is this thaw, there is the risk of greater corruption within the party, and a lack of party discipline. The party has to maintain incredible discipline and ideological conformity. But when the party, and this was one of the reasons for the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the party members start getting corrupted by the underground economy or developing forms of self-interest that are at variance with the party's interest, they cease being good ideological robots, and they become human beings, corrupt ones, but human beings nonetheless. And so what Andropov and Gorbachev had to do in the Soviet Union was ideological purification campaigns and purges of the party, which had become too corrupt. And that's exactly what Xi Jinping has been doing in order to enforce greater party discipline. So that the ideology sets the standard against which deviationism is measured, and Xi Jinping has been using that to try to get the party back online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, early in the Biden administration, the Chinese issued demands of the administration. At the top of the list was that the U.S. not oppose the Chinese communist system. The White House told me that they ignored that, but from the effects and the policies that we're seeing, they are doing that. And this is a fatal flaw in my view. You spoke about telling the truth about Chinese communism. What needs to be done to address this policy flaw of the current administration?
Well, this administration is basing its policy to a large extent on the same premise that the detentists did during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And that is that China it will be a permanent feature. Communist China will be a permanent feature of the global geostrategic landscape. It will always be there, and therefore we have to learn to live with it. This is what all the detentists said, which was the reason that we had this policy of coexistence with them, no matter how many people they threw into the gulag and slaughtered. And so the problem is that there were others of us during the Cold War who recognized that the political change can come, and that there were so many internal contradictions to communism that it could not sustain itself inevitably over a long period of time. The only question was, when would the change come? And that's the same question we can address towards China. Today, I believe that the Chinese Communist Party has a lifespan, and we don't know exactly how long it will last, but the fact of the matter is that we need national leadership, and it's not going to come from this administration. It simply won't, because of their a variety of reasons. You know, they are engaging in willful blindness towards an enormous amount of the stuff that China does. Many of the people associated with it have been corrupted or co-opted. There are a lot of people who just are ignorant of the role of ideology in the system. There are those who actually have some ideological either sympathy or parallelism with communist ideology, because they they accept the relativism, they accept the materialism, the atheism, and they simply don't see a lot of the things that the party represents as a mortal threat to a democratic republic such as ours. So we need new leadership, and we need people who are sufficiently intellectually equipped to be able to deal with reality as it really is.
Yeah. In your strategy for dealing with China, you spoke about the regime vulnerabilities, and you mentioned earlier exposing the breakdown of party discipline. You also suggest that we go on the offensive and conduct political and ideological warfare. What are some of the things that could be done to do that, to wage political and ideological warfare against the CCP?
These are arts which virtually nobody in our foreign policy establishment has studied or is skilled at. And we at the Institute of World Politics, as you know, we're an independent graduate school, and we teach these subjects. We're the only place that does. And it's part of a strategy of winning without kinetic war. And so what does this mean? Well, first of all, you have to, in any kind of a war, you, as Clausewitz counseled, you have to go after the adversary's center of gravity. Mm-hmm. The center of gravity of the Chinese Communist regime is its internal security system. And the nucleus of that internal security system, aside from the obvious things like the informants and the Lao Gai, its Gulag Archipelago, and the system of punishments and all of that, The nucleus is the party's monopoly of communications and information. And we have to break that monopoly. We have to break down the Great Firewall. We have to broadcast to the people over the Voice of America and Radio Free Asia and other independent broadcasting networks. We have to enable the people to hear alternative information, unfiltered information. They have to get the truth in the face of the official lies that come from the regime and its propaganda apparatus. We have to give them alternative ideas. We also have to conduct, along with this, a psychological strategy to encourage people, to give them courage, because there's never going to be political change against the Communist Party without people power. And the people have to have the courage. What took What did it take to get a million people to take to the streets of Moscow when going on any kind of a demonstration in the old Soviet Union was a sure guarantee for punishment? What did it take? People have to feel that they are no longer alone. Mm-hmm. The atomization of society is one of the key elements of totalitarian rule, where you separate every individual from every other, and so that the individual stands alone, all by himself, against the all-powerful party state, and it's done out of fear, because there are so many informants everywhere, you can't trust anybody. So there's an atmosphere of fear and mistrust, and when you can't trust anybody, you can't organize into cells of resistance. You can't communicate with people honestly. And so trying to help people, to give them, helping them break down that atomization, to bring people together is part of it. And communications and broadcasting is one of them. There's a great story during the Cold War of a guy who got on a bus in Warsaw in the 1950s, and he started whistling a song that he heard on Radio Free Europe, a song that you couldn't hear on any of the local communist radio stations. And then soon after that, somebody else started whistling with him, and then somebody else, and pretty soon the entire bus was whistling it, and they all listened, they all looked at each other, and they recognized, we are all on this commuter bus, a bunch of secret dissident listeners to a subversive radio station at pain of punishment. And all of a sudden they could start talking to each other and recognizing that not every single person on that bus was a secret police informant. Yeah. People have to be careful, but that's one way, just in one little example of breaking down the atomization of society. And one of the most decisive things about broadcasting, and it's not just radio, it can be television, it can be internet, is the instantaneity of information. Mm-hmm. One of the what is the first thing that a totalitarian regime does when there is a civil disturbance, a strike, a riot, a demonstration? It cuts off all communications to that locality. Mm-hmm. And then does it crush the demonstration. And so if you, if there is, if the word gets out that there was such a demonstration or a riot, the word also gets out that it was crushed. And so the message to the people is resistance is futile. You can't do anything. It's futile. And so the regime wants to keep you not only in a state of ideological conformity and thought control, but in a state of hopelessness, despair, and futile resignation. But if you get the information to huge numbers of people before the thing was crushed, while the civil disturbance is still going on, others can join it in solidarity. And that's how the solidarity movement mushroomed overnight in Poland when the solidarity strikers in the Lenin shipyard, went on strike. They had developed underground lines of communication to the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe. And before the regime could shut down communications, they shut down communications to the city of Gdansk, the port city, but the information about the fact of the strike was broadcast to millions of Poles before the strike could be crushed.
Yes,
and that's when people rose up in solidarity, and millions of people joined the solidarity movement overnight.
Yeah. And I like your idea of doing the similar thing with China. Make the Chinese people as allies and break the CCP monopoly on information. That's the key. We've been talking with John Lenchowski. He's the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C., and an expert on communism. John, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be with you.
That's it for this episode of Victory Over Communism. Please tune in again in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for listening to Victory Over Communism with award-winning national security journalist Bill Gertz, the only program in the free world unafraid to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how the Communist Party of China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. See you next time on Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.